Welcome to the Hospital Finance Podcast, your go-to source for information and insights that can help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital. And now, the host of the Hospital Finance Podcast, Michael Passanante.
Hi, this is Mike Passanante, and welcome back to the Hospital Finance Podcast. Today, I'm happy to be joined once again by Mike Marola, a founding partner of Winning Strategies Washington, a leading government relations firm based in Washington, D.C., that specializes in hospital issues. And today, Mike is going to provide us with some thoughts on healthcare in the first 100 days of the Trump administration and what might be coming next. So welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here with you and your audience.
So, Mike, let's start at the beginning. Shortly after the inauguration, President Trump signed an executive order that set the wheels in motion for the repeal of the ACA. Can you talk to us about the provisions of that executive order and what that order has accomplished or not accomplished to date?
Sure, Mike, and thanks again for having me. Great to spend some time with you and your audience. Let me start by just distinguishing what the difference between executive orders on sort of on the foreign policy side versus on the domestic side, because as it relates to foreign policy, the president has very broad authority, and their executive orders can really address the minutiae of our relationships with particular countries. But on the domestic side, which is what your audience cares about, the president's power is subject to a lot more constraints. And these types of orders are really used just to set broad policy directions. I want to be real clear, they cannot be used to change laws or regulations, and they're not even appropriate for establishing detailed guidance addressing specific issues. So, as you mentioned, he did sign this order on his first day in office. And, you know, after reciting the administration's commitment to seek repeal of the ACA, it directs the Department of Health and Human Services and other agencies involved in administering Obamacare to the maximum extent permitted by law, that language is important, to minimize the economic burden of the ACA and its pending repeal. So it really directed the Secretary of Health and Human Services and other officials to, one, waive, defer, grant exemptions from, or delay implementation of the law so it doesn't burden individuals, families, hospitals, insurers, and others. Two, to provide greater flexibility to states and cooperate with them in implementing healthcare programs. And three, encourage the development of a free and open market in interstate commerce for the offering of healthcare services and insurance with the goal of achieving and preserving maximum options for patients and consumers. So immediately, the media in particular started to hyperventilate about this. I went back and looked at some of the headlines. You know, the Washington Post said, signed order might start the gutting of the ACA mandate. The New York Times said, Trump issues executive order scaling back parts of Obamacare. And CNN, you know, had breaking news, Trump issues executive order to start rolling back Obamacare.
Right.
So, but despite all of this hype, these headlines really seem to generate more heat than light. And there was a great, I thought, tweet from Sarah Cliff, who is from Vox, who basically said it's akin to a political scream, but a policy whisper. So, and essentially, the executive order neither countermands any portion of the statute nor does away with any of the regulations that were promulgated by the Obama administration on the law. So, contrary to the Washington Post headline, the order does not in any way modify the ACA's individual mandate. This can only be changed by an act of Congress, which we've seen in the past couple weeks how hard that is to do. Second, it doesn't eliminate or modify the tax credit premium subsidies that are crucial to making premiums affordable in the private marketplace, nor does it authorize the new administration to eliminate the Medicaid expansion, which is now helping millions of people in 31 states with their insurance. Again, new legislation is required to modify either of those provisions. And it doesn't impact any of the key rules that have been imposed on insurers as a result of Obamacare. So, you know, the real impact, I think, right now we only have Secretary Price at HHS, we have Seema Verma at CMS, and I think the Senate just approved the deputy, Price's deputy. at HHS. So once the level of sort of political leaders is in place, we may see some more action on this. And the administration does have some other levers that they can pull in terms of impacting the law. And I think that's an issue that you wanted to talk about later. So maybe we can set that aside and pick that up again in a few minutes.
That's great. I appreciate that perspective. That really does, I think, level set where we're at and where we're going. So, Mike, as you intimated a second ago, the first pass at the healthcare reform repeal or new law or did not get through Congress, right? On April 12th, the president reaffirmed his preference for healthcare reform to precede tax reform initiatives, and I suppose that's been kind of moved around, back and forth a little bit since then. Can you briefly explain why the first bill did not pass the House and what might be coming up next?
Sure. Let me start at a real high level first, because, and again, you know what side of the aisle I come down on. I'm a Democrat. I think the failure of the bill really highlighted the fissures that exist on the Republican side of the aisle, you know, in the party sort of writ large. On this issue, I think half the party thinks healthcare is a commodity like any other, gasoline or a private education, where you're only entitled to the amount of it that you can afford. And the other half of the party thinks that in a nation as rich as ours, access to quality healthcare really approaches a fundamental right. And so that's where the breakdown exists. They have not been able to bridge that divide so far on the policy. I think the failure also demonstrates Paul Ryan's really singular focus on tax reform. I think as folks got their head around the bill in D.C., they realized that this was tax reform sort of masquerading as healthcare reform. And, you know, from what I have learned, I think from talking to folks close to the speaker, is that one of his guiding principles is that he wants to be the only speaker since Tip O'Neill over 30 years ago to get tax reform done. He really sees that as his legacy and the prism through which he is viewing sort of all other issues. And there was a great article in Politico magazine last week that was titled Paul Ryan Failed Because His Bill Was a Dumpster Fire, which the whole premise was that this was a failure of policy and legislative strategy, things that were really supposed to be in Paul Ryan's wheelhouse. Wasn't a failure of tactics. In other words, even if President Trump were sort of this master negotiator that, you know, he claims to be, he probably couldn't have even salvaged the effort. This was Ryan's bill. It was his plan. You know, it was his preferred timing. But he really produced one of the worst pieces of major legislation, I think, since I've been doing this in the mid-90s. And it's even more striking because he's widely regarded as the Republicans' big brain on policy issues and a complete wonk. And I think a lot of people in town were really surprised that he didn't lead an effort to craft a conservative but more incremental bill, sort of consistent with President Trump's economic populist agenda. You know, he could have come up with things like more modest cuts on the most needy, smaller tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, and really tried to accommodate the needs of Republican governors who are, you know, the front line on this issue. But he didn't do that. Instead, he crafted really what I thought was a radical bill that would drastically reduce support to low-income Americans and those with serious health conditions, many of whom, by the way, voted for President Trump, while enacting big tax cuts for the wealthy. That there was a great data point in that Politico magazine article that stated that the payout to the top 400 families alone was estimated to exceed the total ACA subsidies in 20 states and the District of Columbia. I think that's why you saw that only 17% of the American public supported the bill. And all of the key players in town, whether that's the AARP, the docs, the hospitals, all the provider community came out against it. Every liberal and conservative think tank in town hated it, albeit for different reasons. And when that CBO score came out, you know, that estimated that 64-year-olds with $26,000 worth of annual income would see their average individual insurance premiums go from $1,700 a year to $14,000 a year. This thing was just doomed. And that's what was so hard for people to get their head around, because Paul Ryan had to know that that was coming. Either he knew it was coming and chose to ignore it, or he didn't know what was in his own bill. So, you know, someday a book is going to be written about this whole process, and I can't wait to read it. It just, at the end of the day, this didn't do anything to help the people who had put the Republicans in charge of Congress and Trump in the White House. And I think that's, at the end of the day, what brought it down.
That's some interesting perspective, as always, Mike. So my next question for you, I mean, in the absence of this new legislation, what is the administration doing, or what can they do, at least in the interim, regarding the ACA or anything around healthcare policy that they might choose to do?
Sure. And I think their first volley in this regard was CMS recently finalized its market stabilization rule, which applies to the following areas. It would loosen the minimum actuarial value by allowing plans to vary by 4% rather than 2%. It would shorten the time frame for open enrollment from November 1st of this year to December 15th of this year. Pre-enrollment verification would be required for anyone signing up for coverage during a special enrollment period. The rule also proposes to defer to state review of network adequacy in states where they have the authority and the means to do so. It would make adjustments to the de minimis range used for determining the level of coverage by providing greater flexibility to issuers of insurance. It would allow insurance companies to collect premiums for prior unpaid coverage before enrolling a patient in the next year's plan, and would provide issuers with additional time to implement proposed changes that are finalized prior to the 2018 coverage year. So, you know, a lot of folks in town, this is a big deal. And beyond this rule, there are a number of other areas where the administration has already begun to act unilaterally, or at least they have the authority to do so. You may remember that back in January, they pulled back the marketing campaign to promote the ACA and the open enrollment period. You know, as I mentioned earlier, they can't do anything on the individual mandate alone, but they can significantly weaken it by directing the IRS not to enforce the penalty for failing to purchase insurance. They haven't done that yet, but that's, you know, one of the arrows in their quiver. They've also indicated their plans to continue the ACA's cost-sharing subsidies, even though these are part of ongoing litigation. Interestingly enough, a lot of Republicans who are opposed to Obamacare publicly, but you've got some Republicans saying that they'd be willing to fund the subsidies this year, which, of course, never would have happened if Obama was in the White House. And on the essential health benefits, Secretary Price could relax the definition of EHB and give states more flexibility to set their benchmark plan. And then finally, on Medicaid waivers, once both Secretary Price and Administrator Verma were in place, they sent a letter to every state governor, basically encouraging greater flexibility in state Medicaid programs and pledging that they would fast-track approval of waivers and demonstration projects. So, you know, politically, what I find most interesting about this is that, again, Republicans in Congress seem to be split on the role the administration should be playing. A number of prominent members, including Congressman Mark Meadows, who's, you've probably heard his name in the media a lot lately. He's the head of the House Freedom Caucus, the ultra-right group that really brought down the American Health Care Act. He basically said the executive branch shouldn't do too much here, that Congress should really be directing Secretary Price and not the other way around. So we'll have to see what, you know, it's something we're watching every day. It's unfolding. And now that Congress is back in town from a 2-week Easter recess, I imagine we'll learn more about what the administration plans to do.
And Mike, let's pivot and talk about provider compensation and how the administration looks at that. We know that CMS has delayed the start of their new mandatory bundle payment models. Can you tell us specifically what they did and why?
Sure. So just to set the table a bit for the audience, as you indicated, in late March, the agency announced that it planned to delay by 3 months several mandatory bundle payment models that were supposed to take effect in July. And it sounds like you've heard, as have we, a lot of industry experts now saying that this really raises questions about the future mandatory payment models under President Trump. And for further context for the audience, under the interim rule, CMS is going to delay from July 1st to October 1st two bundle payment programs for heart attack treatment and bypass surgery billed through Medicare. It's also going to delay the cardiac rehab incentive payment model, which encourages providers in 90 U.S. regions to use cardiac rehab. That'll go from July 1 to October 1 of this year. And it'll postpone from July 1 to October 1 the expansion of the agency's comprehensive care for joint replacement model. I think it's also worth mentioning here that CMS said it would prefer to align the payment periods with the calendar year, and as such, they're seeking comment on further delaying the start of the cardiac bundle payment and the CJR expansion until January 1 of next year. So the official reason behind the delay is to give CMS more time to review the programs and also to give providers more time to prepare for the payment changes. Although it's not lost on anybody in town, at least, that Secretary Price has been a staunch opponent of these programs from the very beginning, which is probably why so many stakeholders, both in town and beyond the Beltway, are saying that HHS's decision to delay the payment models raises questions really about fundamentally how the Trump administration will approach them. For example, Ashisha Jha, who's a professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health, said that the delays might suggest CMS will make the programs voluntary, which he said would affect the pool of participants and ultimately drive up costs. However, a lot of other experts are saying that voluntary bundle payment programs are more effective than mandatory programs. I think notably, the American Hospital Association has criticized the payment models for being too much too soon. The Federation of American Hospitals, in a statement, praised the decision to delay the bundle payment programs, saying that the organization welcomes a fresh set of eyes on the policies. And according to RevCycle Intelligence, CMS's consideration of delaying the bundle payment models until 2018 also could have implications for whether providers could qualify for the higher incentives offered by the Advanced Alternative Payment Model track under MACRA's Quality Payment Program. So I imagine our hospital clients will likely feel sort of varying degrees of the impact of the implementation delay. Some I know that we work with are going to move forward with implementation of these models, or others are really relieved that they're because they're not ready for them. But one area of consensus is that the interim final rule on mandatory payment reforms is not the last that CMS will issue. We're just going to have to wait and see whether they'll delay them again before October or transition them to voluntary programs.
So far, there's been no action to slow down the implementation of MACRA, in contrast to the bundle payment programs we just talked about. Does that seem like something that will proceed in its current form?
Sure. And just as a quick reminder, MACRA itself stands for the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act. And CHIP, of course, is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Just for further context, it was signed into law on April 16, 2015. It had overwhelming bipartisan support, including from Secretary Price when he was still in Congress. But I'm sure, as many members of your audience know, its passage set into motion profound changes in the way the federal government is going to pay physicians moving forward. So, you know, it was put into place to repeal the sustainable growth rate, which had been in place for almost 20 years, and that required Congress to pass last-minute patches every year to try to address the potential cuts that physicians would have experienced without congressional action. And it basically sets up a number of opportunities for physicians and hospitals to work together to improve outcomes, while at the same time it makes fee-for-service increasingly unattractive in order to encourage providers to develop and implement alternative payment models. So implementation started on January 1st of this year and includes two payment options. The first is the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, or MIPS, which is really a complex pay-per-performance system based on traditional fee-for-service. And the other option, participation in an advanced APM, alternative payment model, is in reality not currently an option for the majority of providers. So the main issue currently confronting providers in macro is that despite considerable flexibility in 2017, when full implementation arrives, the MIPS will make fee-for-service untenable at a much faster pace than the development and implementation of viable alternative payment models. So this means that unless something changes, a large number of providers are going to be pushed out of fee-for-service and over the cliff before they really have a safe place to land. So there are essentially two ways to address the problem, and physician groups in D.C. have been urging Health and Human Services to take a step back and make some changes. The first is to make MIPS less onerous, and the other is to greatly accelerate the development and implementation of viable alternative payment models. So given Secretary Price's background and his experience as a physician and his delay for the bundled payment program, I think a lot of folks feel he will slow down implementation. I think that's sort of a safe bet for now, but unfortunately, just like a lot of other things in healthcare and town right now, we have to sort of take a day-by-day approach to it. But I think that's it's a safe bet.
So we've reached the first 100 days, and that's a, you know, it's a marker for really any type of administration at almost any level. But it really is just the beginning, as we've talked about. You know, there's still the team really getting in place in certain levels of the government to tackle some of these complex issues. So much more to come over the next several weeks or months, Mike. What do you see happening? What do you think's next on the agenda for healthcare?
Sure. Well, interesting enough, President Trump last week, he had this tweet that no administration has accomplished more in the first 90 days than his has, which you won't be surprised is not exactly true. If you look at, you know, especially FDR, it was the president who sort of instituted this 100-day benchmark. But, you know, there hasn't been a major piece of legislation passed by Congress for the president as part of the president's agenda. So I think the next 100 days are going to look a lot like the previous, where he still has to get his team in place throughout the administration. I think they're going to continue to struggle to get something passed on healthcare, because I think the framework that they're addressing it in is just, it's going to make it impossible for the Republicans to come to agreement on their own. So we could see this, they could be debating healthcare through next year's election, I think conceivably. At some point, though, they are going to have to move on to tax reform. And I think if the president wanted to sort of look at this in a more narrow way and just send up to Congress a corporate tax reform bill, sort of very narrow, he might be able to get that passed. But I don't think either he or Paul Ryan, as I said earlier, want to think that small right now. They want to think big, and so I don't think that's going to go anywhere either. So, you know, there's likely to be some events overseas that will take up a lot of his time, but you know, domestically, I think we're still going to be talking about healthcare and tax reform at the end of the next 100 days.
Mike, it's always great to have you on the show to provide your perspective and clarity around these issues. So we appreciate it and look forward to having you back on as things progress with healthcare in this new administration.
Terrific, Michael. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike.
If you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss on the Hospital Finance Podcast, or if you'd like to be a guest, drop us a line at update@bessler.com.
This concludes today's episode of the Hospital Finance Podcast. For show notes and additional resources to help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital, visit Bessler.com/podcasts. The Hospital Finance Podcast is a production of Bessler Consulting.